From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
You've got what is basically a hippie commune. Everybody thought hippies were just a San Francisco thing, and no one in Tennessee sure knew what a commune was.
Joe Nick Potoski, the author of Willie Nelson, An Epic Life. We'll hear more from Potoski on the life and times of Nelson as we explore the world of country music in this hour. Also, the philosophy of the man in black, Johnny Cash. And we'll look at love, death, and country music.
One of the things I love about country music and Patsy Cline's music especially is how it's music for adults, or it was music for adults. It's certainly pop music, but it wasn't pop music aimed at someone under 20 years old.
The roots of country music run deep in Carlene Carter's family. Carter's the third generation of a country music dynasty. Her mother is June Carter Cash, and her grandmother is Maybelle Carter, one of the founding members of country music's first family, the Carter family. Carlene Carter's father is a country music star, Carl Smith. And her stepfather? None other than the man in black, Johnny Cash. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon spoke to Carlene Carter about her new album, Stronger.
Carlene Carter has always lived her life fast. At the age of 15, she got married and had a child. But it took her a long time to release her new album, Stronger, her first album of new material since 1995. A lot happened over the last 13 years. 2003 was an especially difficult year for Carter.
On paper, it's kind of unbelievable, and it was definitely unbelievable in my heart, you know, and in my life. But I lost my partner of 16 years, Howie Epstein, who was also, I worked with a great deal and did a couple of my favorite albums. He was a really good producer. He was my sweetheart. I loved him very much. Lost him to a drug overdose in February of 2003. Then my mother passed away in May. That was kind of a shock because she was so feisty. We all thought she'd live to be 100. She'd have a little cane, and a little silver-headed cane, and she'd be tapping her great-grandkids on the head with it. And then it was really no surprise when Big John passed away. But to lose my little sister was the big, huge, you know, it was like how much more can happen. I was afraid to answer the phone, you know, for a long time. I still am. I hate it when the phone rings early in the morning because that's when I got all the calls telling me that someone was gone.
Sweet baby sister, held the world up on her shoulders. She had a spirit like a twister. This life could not hold her. Always one to run so fast down a track heading nowhere. She was cool until the train crashed and she died trying to get.
That song really was the song about that year, about the 2003 year. I wrote it from the perspective of me talking about my little sister, but the chorus of it, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. I had to come to terms with the loss of those people that I love so much, and that hard year, I had to come to terms with it, and that summed it up. You know, I think Nietzsche said that, so I never thought I'd be drawing from Nietzsche, but
Nietzsche is one of your influences. Who would have thought that?
Yeah, it's like my mom would be so proud. She always wanted me to have some couth.
In a recent LA Times feature, Holly Gleason described Carter's new album as a song cycle that documents the pain, loss, and courage it took to regain control of her life. So I'm curious, does Carter think that Stronger is her most autobiographical album to date?
Yes. Every song pretty much has a story. Every song is about a certain situation and things in my life that have meant something to me at the time, you know, whether it be funny stuff or pissed off stuff or happy stuff or, you know, heartbreak or, you know, grief. And I think that those are like all human emotions that most human beings go through at some point in their life. We've all lost somebody. We've all been happy. You know, we've all been sad. I had something I needed to say. It's like, you know, people say, where have you been? It's just like collecting material, you know. It's like, that's what I've been doing. I've been doing research. So I'm very proud of it. I'm really proud of the things I got to write about. There's a lot of faith in this album from my end.
Bring Love is the song that set Carter on the path to her new album.
Bring Love is kind of the story of myself and my husband, Joe Breen. And I did a play on words when I said Breen Love. B-R-E-E-N is his name. When he whisked me away in our Altima, which was his chariot awaits, was actually an Altima, a beat-up Altima, I'll add, I said, well, what should I bring with me? And he said, just bring love. And that was it. And that was pretty much it. I took a little creative license in our actual trip across country to come back to Tennessee, because we actually flew, but we gave the car away and flew. He took me to a Starbucks, and he said, I'm going to see my kids for Christmas, and when I come back, we're going to be together. And I went, okay. He said, I'm going to tell you how it's going to be. And I was like, okay. He went off, and I wrote that song. And he came back, and we've been together ever since.
He said, settle down, cowgirl. Let me tell you how it's going to be, you and me. Leave that suitcase packed full of sorrow. I'm going to take you home to Tennessee, to your family. He said, my chair awaits to carry you out of these gates of this prison we've been living to.
Actually, I wrote The Bitter End with my friend Mark W. Winchester. It's autobiographical. It's my story about being 15 years old and basically just running down that road ragged, you know, having babies and going to school and having a job, writing songs, going on the road, all that stuff. I was writing because I thought Big John should sing it, Cash should sing it. Unfortunately, he passed away before I finished it.
A Southern girl.
One of the most beautiful songs on the album is called To Change Your Heart. It was inspired by Carter's divorce from British singer-songwriter Nick Lowe.
It's odd that I would write it so many years later, but he was a very huge part of my life, really important emotional part of my life, and I still love him to bits. He's great. But we split up, and we didn't get divorced for some time. Partly because Nick didn't want to have to marry somebody else, I think. He would say to his girlfriends, whoever wanted to get married, he'd say, oh, she won't possibly divorce me. Carlene won't give me a divorce. Finally, after living with Howie Epstein for a couple of years, I kind of thought I really ought to get divorced. But when the papers came, it hit me. Right up to the very end in signing the papers, I always thought that we would end up being old together. You know, but it's funny how things change. You know, Nick is very happy in his life. I'm very happy in my life. And we were both really young when we fell in love. And I still always will have this soft spot for him. But that's how I felt. It was like, what could I have ever said or what could I say to change your heart? Because, you know, we had hurt each other, both of us had hurt each other so much in funny, odd ways, not necessarily on paper what people would think. That's all I could come up with was, like, what could I say to change your heart? You know, because I really thought somewhere in my romantic, lovely sense of tragedy mind that we would end up together.
In black and white, unspoken words said in my heart is stone. The terms agreed on paper stained by tears, we'll live apart for the rest of our years. A change of
So you mentioned, Carlene, that creating this album, Stronger, has helped you come to terms with all the trials and tribulations you've experienced over the past few years. I think I know the answer, but I shouldn't presume anything. Are you feeling stronger now?
Don't I look stronger?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to meet you in a dark alley. I wouldn't want to get on your bad side.
No, I'm bad, baby. No, I'm feeling really optimistic, hopeful, and excited about the future, and that is someplace I wasn't quite sure I'd get to again. And so I have a whole new zest on life and a whole new outlook. And it's really exciting, you know. And I am really, truly starting all over again in so many ways, but it's almost like I've got the wisdom and the experience of all my other things, you know, somewhere lodged back in here. But I really feel like a kid in the excitement of doing it all again.
What doesn't kill me makes me stronger.
Carlene Carter with the title track from her new album, Stronger. Carter spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. You can find a link to Carter's website on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, Dana Jennings shares his memories of growing up during the golden age of country music from the 1950s to the 1970s. And we'll find out what we can learn about the idea of justice by listening to Johnny Cash as we continue our Hour on Country Music. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Dana Jennings is an editor with the New York Times. Jennings grew up in a town in New Hampshire that had more cows than people when he was born. His family lived their lives to the sound of country music, which also shaped their values. Jennings revisits his memories of growing up with that sound in a book called Sing Me Back Home, Love, Death, and Country Music. Dana Jennings talked to Ann Strangechamps about his book.
What I ended up with is a call and response structure. You know, where the person suggests a song and a song suggests the person. And what I'm hoping is that, you know, when I'm writing about Grammy Jennings and writing about Patsy Cline and She's Got You, that it sets up additional resonances for the reader that wouldn't be there if I were just writing a memoir or if I were just writing about Patsy Cline.
Now, tell me something about Grammy Jennings. I mean, she's not your kind of apple pie baking sort of picture of a grandma, is she? She was kind of a hard-drinking and hard-loving woman.
Yeah, she had a hard life. I mean, she was an orphan who grew up in northern New Hampshire. When she became a teenager, she started running away from the orphanage. When she was a teenager, she contracted tuberculosis. And as far as I know, she went to the mountains for a while to get healthy. She knew what she wanted, and when she saw it, she took it. You know, there was no pretense about her. As I say in the book, you know, like Will Rogers, she never met a man she didn't like.
And a lot of these men were other women's husbands.
Sometimes, yeah. Or other, you know, other women's boyfriends. Or, you know, as I say in the book, she was often the other woman. You know, one of the conversations I'll never forget, I was in college by this time, and she had married this guy mainly for his Social Security check. You know, this is the late 70s. And I remember she was visiting us and, you know, at that point she was, she was probably around 70 and she was complaining to my dad about her sex life. And of course, you know, my dad didn't want to hear this. And, you know, I was standing there just kind of flabbergasted. But that's the kind of woman she was. And, mm-hmm. and she did calm down a bit when she got older. You know, fortunately, she was able to quit drinking at some point, which actually allowed me to get to know her.
I've got your picture that you gave to me, and it's signed with love, just like it used to be. The only thing different, the only thing new, I've got your picture. She's got you.
Well, tell me how you think the Patsy Cline's song She's Got You fits her. It's such a sad song.
Well, I think her life was a sad life. You know, there was never enough money. When I think about her life, you know, at best it's twilight and it's often after midnight. And you know, I think she was a woman of dark reveries, and I think Patsy Cline's ballads lend themselves to those dark reveries. And I, you know, and one of the things I love about country music and Patsy Cline's music especially is how it's music for adults, or it was music for adults. It's certainly pop music, But it wasn't pop music aimed at someone under 20 years old.
What do you like about this song in particular?
It's a neat combination of being both plush and bitter. You know, because she did have such a plush voice, the orchestration around the music, you know, is vivid and beautiful. And so you have these trappings, and then you have these very bitter truths coming from Patsy as she sings the song. And I think, you know, my grandmother, first of all, as an adult woman, could respond to those bitter truths. But on the other hand, just as a listener, she could take some solace in the beauty of Klein's voice and in the beauty of the music.
Let's talk a little about your Uncle Lloyd, who shows up in your chapter on country music songs about drinking.
Well, he was just one of these kind of classic rural guys. You know, he'd worked just enough so he had a little bit of money in his pocket on Friday night and Saturday night. You know, he was handsome in a very country way. You know, he had very dark, thick hair. And, you know, and on Saturday night, he'd put on his black jeans and his black shirt with the old-fashioned kind of lightning stitches on the breast pockets. And, you know, he'd pile his hair up as high as he possibly could. And, you know, basically, he went out to get drunk and find a woman. Sometimes he would go with his woman, you know, to go out. But on Saturday night, he got to be kind of a bar predator, but not in he was definitely, you know, he was kind of a handsome weasel.
So the song that you kind of fit with Uncle Lloyd is "There Stands the Glass" by Webb Pierce.
There stands the glass that will ease all my pain, that will settle my brain. It's my first one to take. There stands the glass.
So what can you tell us about that song?
One of the reasons I picked it is, you know, Uncle Lloyd liked to fancy himself looking like Webb Pierce or Farron Young, kind of 1950s honky-tonk guys. And "There Stands the Glass" is just, it was the first, you know, really major country hit that addressed drinking in a deep way. I mean, there had certainly been drinking songs before, but there's a lot of pain in Pierce's voice. And, you know, one of the things that contributed to my uncle dying was alcoholism. You know, my uncle understood at a very young age that he was an alcoholic. And at certain times, you know, he could, through willpower, he could keep himself from drinking. But he, you know, as we understand now, he didn't understand that he had a disease and that, you know, that he could have gone into a program or some kind of treatment. And I think "There Stands the Glass" helped him understand himself in some way. And I think he could really identify with the narrator of the song. You know, Uncle Lloyd was a guy who'd get up in the morning and drink coffee brandy for breakfast. You know, that's the kind of life that he lived.
What does Webb Pierce sing about the song?
The singer is looking at, I assume, a glass of beer. It looks really enticing. And there is a momentary struggle in the song where the singer knows he shouldn't pick up the glass and start drinking, but that glass of beer is just too seductive.
There stands the glass, fill it up to the brim, till my troubles grow dim. It's my first one to take. She fell down on her bended knees.
ask you about a whole category of songs that I'd never really thought about before, murder songs. And there's one in particular you write about, Knoxville Girl. It was recorded by the Louvin Brothers in 1956. What can you tell me about this song?
You know, it's one of the darkest songs in the whole country catalog. It tells the story of a murder of a young woman by her boyfriend and possibly her, you know, fiancé. And it never explains why. And its roots go back to, you know, the 16th or 17th century, to an old English murder ballad. You know, first of all, the song itself is sung by the Louvin Brothers is just chilling and otherworldly. And then for it to be a single in 1956, it's so jarring and strange. It would be as if some early English novel were to somehow sneak onto the bestseller lists again.
It's a fascinating song. I was kind of puzzling over it because you're right, the words are really creepy in the story. You know, here's this guy who's going walking by a river with this beautiful girl he loves and for no good reason drowns her. But, you know, the tone is sort of cheerful, even faintly happy. Don't you think? You know, he's singing, go down, Knoxville girl. It's sort of like he's happy to watch her sink and drown.
Actually, you're right. The song is a little quicker than you'd expect, you know, as far
as... Considering the subject matter.
Right.
Well, I wondered if it's like a piece of black humor. It struck me as, you know, like a musical version of a Coen Brothers film.
I think you could listen to it that way. That's a good insight. You know, it's one of those old story songs. You know, it's a tale that's been in the air for centuries. And who knows, the Louvins, that there's probably verses to that song that exist in the hills and hollows that none of us have ever heard, or, you know, there are verses to that song that are secreted away somewhere in Wales or Ireland or Britain.
They carried me down to Knoxville and put me in a cell. My friends all tried to get me out, but none could go my bail. I'm here to waste my life away down in this dirty old jail, because I murdered that Knoxville girl, the girl I love so well.
The Louvin Brothers with Knoxville Girl. Dana Jennings is the author of Sing Me Back Home, Love, Death, and Country Music. He spoke with Anstrain Shams. John Huss is the co-editor, along with David Werther, of Johnny Cash and Philosophy, The Burning Ring of Truth. In the book, 21 Philosophers Wax Philosophical About the Music of Johnny Cash, exploring such themes as artistic creativity and individual identity. Huss's essay is called Johnny Cash and Justice. The essay starts with an analysis of the Johnny Cash song, Jacob Green.
Jacob Green got busted for possession. Next morning early, he appeared in court. But he was sent to jail to wait to be tried at some later date. Next morning early, there came a sad report. At the jail, they took away his clothes to shame him and to make sure Jacob Green had no pride left. They cut off all his hair. Today they found him hanging there, afraid to face the day he killed himself. It happened yesterday, and if you turn your head away, somewhere in some dirty hole, the scene will be rerun. Not only Jacob Green, but many more you've never seen. It could be someone that you love gets done like Jacob Green got done. It could be someone that you love gets done like Jacob Green got done.
In this song, which was a B-side and it is not that well known and was actually recorded in a Swedish prison, the protagonist of the song is a fellow named Jacob Green, who is arrested on some sort of drug possession charge, and he's humiliated when his trial is delayed and he's sent back to lockup. He is humiliated. They cut off his hair, they take his clothes away, and he is so distraught that he hangs himself. And that's really the setup to what I think are some of the interesting issues that are raised in the song. Basically, what happens from that point forward is Jacob's father hires lawyers, there's an investigation, the sheriff, quote-unquote, retires, a couple of guards are fired, they repaint Jacob's cell, and basically there's this idea that there's some sort of justice in atoning for what had been done to somebody. But the deeper issue that Cash raises is that stuff really doesn't matter. Systemically, at its root, what is going on in the way that criminal suspects are treated, these are larger issues about how our social institutions, such as prisons, are set up. And he leaves that question open. And he also does something very interesting. And he says, and this is what he does a lot in many of his songs, it's not simply that this one particular individual was mistreated. There's a line in the song that says, could be someone that you love gets done like Jacob Green got done, which basically my interpretation of that would be when we are thinking about the fairness of our social institutions, we ought to be imagining not that some anonymous victim was treated unjustly, but it could have been us or someone whom we love. And that's how we should be thinking about it when we hear about such instances. And that's what should move us to change how things are done.
Do you think that Johnny Cash was trying to work out whether somebody like Jacob Green deserved what he got? You write a lot about what you call justice as dessert. And I guess that's an issue that comes up again and again in the Johnny Cash songs you talk about.
Well, I think there's a couple of issues there that I think are interesting. The first is that Johnny Cash was very much aware that the circumstances that people find themselves in often are thrust upon them. They're not entirely of their own making. They're not entirely, an individual's not, often is not personally fully responsible for the causal conditions that brought about some state of affairs that they're being blamed for. So, and the other side of it, though, is that many of the prisoners and even suspects that Cash writes about did commit the crime that they were accused of. He doesn't have a lot in his songs about falsely accused and falsely imprisoned people. There is a strong sense, actually, that Johnny Cash believed that most of the prisoners about whom he wrote had done wrong and were serving their time and knew that they had done wrong, and they just had a longing, like in Folsom Prison Blues, the prisoner in that song, you know, just longs to be free. So there are these two sides. To some extent, there are these wider societal circumstances that put someone in a bad position. In Jacob Green's case, maybe it's how he looked got him singled out. But by the same token, presumably he was in possession of drugs and in violation of the law. So there's this sort of conflict between individual responsibility and culpability for wrongdoing, and the fact that larger forces outside one's control put one in certain kinds of circumstances. And Johnny Cash, I think, was constantly trying to work out the moral dynamics of these two opposing forces that result in, you know, someone being found guilty or at least being suspected of wrongdoing.
Yeah. So what do you think we learn about justice from listening to Johnny Cash?
Well, I think that one thing we learn about it is not really cut and dried exactly what justice is. I think Johnny Cash was very good at spotting injustices where he saw them, but he was also very, very good at painting a nuanced picture of moral scenarios that were complex and were not so simple and black and white matters. He showed us that there's a lot to think about in just the predicaments that many people find themselves in. His whole moral vision is very much fraught with uncertainty and searching. And I think the one, if I were to derive a single lesson from this aspect of Johnny Cash's songwriting, it would be something like, don't judge so quickly. Matters are often complex. What we need to do is we need to have some compassion for people who are in a compromised moral situation, imagine ourselves in their situation, and think about the issue from a more systematic viewpoint than just the plight of one particular individual.
It happened yesterday, and if you turn your head away, somewhere in some dirty hole, the scene will be rerun. Not only Jacob Green, but many more you've never seen. It could be someone that you love gets done like Jacob Green got done. It could be someone that you love gets done like Jacob Green got done.
The Man in Black, Johnny Cash, with a song called Jacob Green. John Huss is the author of the essay Johnny Cash and Justice. It's featured in Johnny Cash and Philosophy, The Burning Ring of Truth. Huss co-edited the book with David Werther. John Huss also performs with the John Huss Moderate Combo. You can find a link to the combo's website on our website, ttbook.org. Do you have a favorite country music philosopher? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll explore the epic life of Willie Nelson as we conclude our hour on country music. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Willie Nelson is not just a country music icon, he's an American music icon. Joe Nick Potoski's been writing about the redheaded stranger for 35 years. Now, Potoski has written a comprehensive biography called Willie Nelson, An Epic Life. Joe Nick Potoski told Steve Paulson that Nelson first found success in Nashville as a songwriter. Took a while to establish himself as a singer.
There were two factors. One is the pecking order in Nashville was very specific. If you were a songwriter, they wanted you to be a songwriter. If you were a producer, they wanted you to be a producer. If you were a performer, they wanted you to be a performer. That was one part of the proposition. The other was, going back even into the 1950s, Willie had a reputation as singing behind the beat. He phrased like a jazz singer. And in country music, this was a no-no. You were supposed to sing right on the beat, like someone like Ray Price or Ernest Tubwood. The one exception that I could find before Willie of a Nashville star who didn't sing on the beat was Hank Williams. And Hank said, "I don't know what the beat is. I just sing, and I'm playing along with the music." In Willie's case, Willie knew what he was doing, but other musicians, when he would sit in with them, they would laugh at him. "Man, can't you stay on the beat? Can't you keep up?" And yet Joe Allison, the head of Liberty Records, who signed Willie to a performing contract in 1961, and largely he signed him because he was a great songwriter and he could get dibs on his songs. But Allison recognized Willie as a phraser and made the comment, "He sings like Sinatra." Hmm. And in fact, on his first album that he did for Liberty, it was arranged by an arranger in Los Angeles who had worked with Sinatra and had worked with other pop and jazz singers. He has musicians that are on that record that are both country musicians, but he also had the jazz players Red Callender on bass and Earl Palmer on drums backing him up. So Liberty kind of understood what he was, but he still didn't sell worth a darn, so he ended up going back to Nashville and signing with RCA.
Hmm. Can you give me an example of a song of Willie Nelson singing behind the beat?
Well, I think one of the best examples of Willie singing behind the beat would be his version of Crazy.
Which, of course, he had written for Patsy Cline, and she had turned it into an enormous hit, but he had done his own version of it.
I'm crazy. Crazy for feeling so lonely. crazy, crazy for feeling so blue.
This was his second big hit. This is the one that really busted everything through. And when he first started talking about putting this song together, a fellow that he worked with in Houston named Paul Buskirk, who was a real mentor, turned him on to Django Reinhardt and actually backed him on some recording sessions, talked about writing a song like the great Floyd Tillman did. And Floyd was the first composer of cheating songs in country music and a very much of an influence on Willie Stiler. And Floyd had done a song called I Want My Baby Back. And it starts with this pause, baby, and then there's a pause, and then the song moves on. And that kind of phrasing there, Willie did on Crazy, and sings behind it, and then he catches up, and then he gets behind and catches up. He knows what he's doing. And most of the backing musicians knew what he was doing in the studio in Nashville. But other people, they were thinking, man, that guy can't keep a beat.
So his version of Crazy was never a big hit then?
No, it was, again, part of the demos that he did at the Monument Records studio in Nashville in order to get his songs heard by the producers and the performers.
I'm crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you.
What was Willie Nelson's first big hit as a singer?
Really, his first hit was in 1975 on the album Redheaded Stranger. The first single that came off of it was Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain.
In twilight glow I see blue eyes crying in the rain. When we kissed goodbye and parted, I knew we'd never meet again. Love is like a dying ember, and only memories remain. I'll remember blue eyes crying in the rain.
So did he start to assume the aura that he has today? I mean, sort of this larger-than-life figure who, to some degree, was the voice of country music?
You know, I think that was always in process. What's interesting to me is the public perception is he had to have his house burned down outside of Nashville to retreat to Texas in 1971, which is where his gig money was always made. And there he made a stand first in a rural area called Bandera in the Hill Country. And then he moved to Austin in 1972 and got busy. And he basically created his own sound and brought the hippies and the rednecks together. But my research showed me that all this was already in process during his Nashville years, that in 1964, with his songwriting royalty money, he bought a big spread outside of Nashville called Ridgetop, and it was a farm. He kept horses, he raised hogs, he raised crops, and it was basically his retreat. And through one of his sidemen, Wade Ray, he learned about Astara, which was kind of a metaphysical, not quite a religion, but a path. And he and Johnny Bush used to read Khalil Gibran in the libraries and Edgar Casey back even beginning in the early 60s.
Edgar Casey, the psychic.
Exactly. So by the late 60s, what you've got in Ridgetop is you've got Willie's mama and daddy who had divorced very early, living on either side of them with their spouses. You've got band members living nearby on this property. You've got friends. You've got kin. You've got what is basically a hippie commune. But at the time, no one knew. Everybody thought hippies were just a San Francisco thing. And no one in Tennessee sure knew what a commune was. So it really took coming to Texas and then consorting with hippies openly and overtly, as well as his fan base, which we could call rednecks, that it became obvious this guy is an out-of-the-box thinker.
Well, that is so strange how he was able to appeal to these seemingly two totally different audiences, hippies and rednecks, who often hated each other. How did he do it?
Well, I think it speaks to his appeal today that he has this talent of people being able to project things on him, and more often than not, whatever they're projecting on him, they're right. And what he found was, in Austin in particular, as he started noticing at his regular honky-tonk gigs, hippies were showing up. And that was no easy thing, because hippies risked getting their ass kicked by showing up in places like that. But Willie made a concerted effort, after playing a couple benefits, to play a place in Austin called the Armadillo World Headquarters. And it was definitely a hippie joint. It was a concert hall that was run by a collective. And they had already been bringing in West Coast country rock bands like, the Flying Burrito Brothers, Rye Cooter, acts like that. So they were hip to, country could be cool. And certainly when Eddie Wilson, the head honcho of the Armadillo, had met Willie, he was expecting him. He was anticipating him. He had heard the album called Yesterday's Wine, which was a big flop for RCA in 1972. But it was an album that was about a man contemplating mortality, and pretty weighty stuff for country music. No wonder it was a flop. But hippies did hear it and could recognize this guy's a deep thinker. So when Willie showed up at the Armadillo wanting to play a gig, the Armadillo welcomed him with open arms, and basically he brought two different audiences to the gig. The Armadillo crowd, who were there because Greasy Wheels had opened up, and they were tolerant enough that this guy seemed to be cool. He had an earring in his ear, and his hair was a little bit shaggy. And Willie's traditional crowd that had been following him throughout the 60s, they ventured into the Armadillo because they wanted to hear Willie Nelson. And he gave both crowds what they wanted, which was country music, but it was really rocked up. It was out of the box. It had deep lyrics. And he could match any rock band in getting down and going on a long jam. So it was the perfect situation for him. And through that, he cobbled this brand new audience that Nashville had no clue was out there.
She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good time and man. She loves him in spite of his ways. She don't understand.
Well, one of the remarkable things about Willie Nelson is not only is he a mega country star, but he's not just a country star. I mean, he's a guy who's managed to cross genres. And, I mean, it's actually kind of hard to define what music he does. I mean, do you think he changed the nature of country music?
I think Willie definitely did change the nature of country music. And really, if you want to look at it with perspective, American music. Because he always seemed to do things the hard way, and go out of his way to do it the hard way. When he made Redheaded Stranger in 1975, he had a band that was playing three-hour shows, two drums, two bassists, and they could jam as good as the Allman Brothers or Charlie Daniels Band. So what album did he deliver to Columbia? A stripped-down, spare acoustic album that clocked in at 35 minutes. It had nothing to do with his live show. Similarly, after One of the Outlaws, he delivered an album to Columbia that had nothing to do with country music. And that was Stardust, a collaboration that he had done with the great organist and pianist Booker T. Jones, the head of Booker T. and the MGs. And they basically met each other in Malibu, California, and came up with a list of their favorite songs from the Great American Songbook that they'd grown up with in the 30s and 40s.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song, the melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration.
And again, throughout his career, he's done whatever the label tells him not to do.
Okay, one final question. I'm going to put you on the spot. What do you think is the greatest Willie Nelson song?
Oh, boy. You know, my greatest Willie Nelson song, it depends on the day and the time and the mood. I think right now the one song that stands the test of time for me because it gets to the heart of what I would call white man's blues is the song Nightlife, because it really is his life. When he recorded it for the first time in Houston, Texas, it marked a sea change in the music he had been doing and the recordings he had made. Somehow he became very sophisticated, very introspective. And boy, every time I hear that song, it just goes straight to my heart.
When the evening sun goes down, you will find me hanging round. The nightlife ain't a good life, but it's my life. Many people just like me dreaming of old used to be's, and the nightlife ain't a good life, but it's my life.
Joe Nick Patosky is the author of Willie Nelson, An Epic Life. Patosky also wrote the liner notes for the new Willie Nelson box set, One Hell of a Ride. Joe Nick Patosky spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 68A, Sturm und Twang, Country Music. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickard. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.